Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week, Republican New York State Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay. He's from the 120th District in New York. Leader Barclay, thank you so much.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me on. I always enjoy doing your show, and I think we talk about a lot of substantive issues, and hopefully your listeners enjoy it too.
Yeah, you know, it makes them think, for sure. And as we are thinking about New York State government and politics, the big news of late has been the budget, $254 billion state budget. That's a lot of money to spend. And I want to start with your general thoughts. I think I know where you're going with this, Will Barclay, but we'll see. Your general thoughts on the budget itself.
Well, let me say this, and we'll talk a lot about the budget. The process was better this year, believe it or not, even though the budget was late. I think the latest has been in a decade. We're over a month late on it. This year, we passed it in almost daylight. We passed it around 9:30. I think we finished up in the Assembly. Actually beat the Senate, which is rare for the Assembly to do. Usually we go a day or so longer than the Senate. So I was pleased, at least from that standpoint, from a process standpoint, although there wasn't as much transparency, and obviously the input from the Republican Party doesn't get heard as much, obviously, as the majority. So that's always, I think, issues that can be worked upon and improved upon. The budget itself, as you said, it's a huge, massive $254 billion. That's $13 billion more than last year. David, I may have mentioned this to you before. I started here in the Assembly a long time ago, but not that long ago, and it was $78 billion when I started. So we've gone for a little over 20 years. We've gone from $78 billion to $254 billion. In the last 5 years alone, I had my staff pull this statistic. It's increased $77 billion, or 43%. So, you know, we've been spending like drunken sailors. I think that cliche works. It's very accurate. And the alarm bells I've been trying to set off is, this is great right now. It's fun while it lasts, but this is not a sustainable system. And at some point, this is going to have to be reined in, or we're going to have to face, you know, some very serious, serious consequences.
Will Barclay, I can hear your argument now, because so many, even on the Democratic side, are concerned. I mean, you have what is massive cuts from the federal government, and we've continued to spend here in New York. It just seems to me you're going to end up in a special session in the fall, and there'll be cutting that will have to take place then.
Yeah, I would have hoped, and I actually mentioned this to the governor, that, you know, let's show some constraint in our spending now instead of saying we'll have to come back and, you know, do mid-year cuts. Why not show just some constraint? And when I say, you know, everybody runs around and says, well, we can't, what are you going to cut? What are you going to cut? I always say, we don't have to cut anything. What we have to do is just slow the growth. You know, just in, for instance, in school aid spending, we have 7.3 fewer students than we did 10 years ago, 192,000 less students, but our spending in education has gone up 61% during that same time. So again, I don't think we have to go crazy and cut, bare the bone right down cuts. But what we ought to do is really just slow the growth of spending. We can't do 5 to 10% increases every year.
Well, what about this process you're talking about? You say it was better, and yet transparency is still an issue. You have Senator Skoufis, a Democrat, who's gone directly after the governor, saying it's a big power grab, that she wants more executive control, and she's cutting out many of the legislators in the process, and they even want to do a constitutional amendment. Doesn't look like that'll probably happen in the Senate, but what do you make of that?
Well, I do find that dangerous, and I've learned my lessons from the past when, I mean, dangerous to how much power the governor has in the budgetary process and what we gave her to actually make unilateral cuts throughout the year, if need be. You know, you recall, we gave a lot of power to Governor Cuomo during the COVID era, and I think, you know, hindsight, I think that was a mistake. So I think we, you know, we should have learned our lesson from that and not provide all this power, but you know, in New York, the governor does have tremendous power during this budget process, and particularly when the budget's late. She could, if she wanted, to start putting policy in any of the budget extenders and force the legislature to make a decision whether they want to, you know, keep government running or accept her policies. David Paterson did that a number of years ago. Fortunately, the governor did not do that, but I'd be open, you know, to taking, you know, making a more balanced process, giving the legislature some more power. The problem I have, of course, is, you know, the governor tends to be a little bit more conservative in the budgetary process versus the legislature. So you give the legislature too much power, I think we're going to continue on with some of the spending woes that we have. So that, you know, I'd like to see, I guess, what exactly is being proposed in a constitutional amendment before jumping on board and saying it's a great idea.
Well, and I mean, on the national level with DOGE, isn't that also a bypass of the legislature in an attempt to cut spending?
Well, yeah, it depends on what you call that. I mean, they would claim that it's, you know, fraud and waste. I don't know if you need the legislature to always, you know, get back on and say you can't cut this. This is fraudulent. And I think in the national, I think they give the executive branch like blocks of money to spend how the executive seems appropriate. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that's an apples to apples comparison.
Well, let's stick with just a moment the flip side of the inevitable special session we just spoke about. Because the governor came out and said, and I have the quote here, "I have to be honest with everyone in the state. We've already lost $1.3 billion in funding from the federal government under the Trump administration. I expect we're going to lose more," she said at a press event in Syracuse. "I can't stand here and commit that we're going to be able to backfill every dollar that's lost from the federal government. So I encourage the delegation, everybody who lives in this region and represents this area, to really fight hard in Washington to try to get that money back." Now, everything is in a political context here. How much of these moves are meant from the Democratic side, Republican Will Barkley, Assembly Minority Leader, to hoist this all on the Republicans? In other words, we're going to put out a $254 billion budget, check every wish list we have, and then when the mean old Republicans come along and cut things, we can blame them.
Right. Well, I appreciate making that argument, David. I completely agree. First, let's talk about the cuts, because as far as I can see, these haven't really materialized. I'm not sure what she's referring to. For instance, there was some COVID money, I think $300 or $400 million, that wasn't spent that the government, you know, the feds took back, that seemed wholly appropriate in the light of the fact that the state hadn't spent that money. We're no longer in the COVID pandemic. So I don't know what she's talking about with these cuts, but there's been a lot of fear mongering out there, but I really haven't heard from the Trump administration exactly what the cuts, you know, are being proposed. In fact, I don't know if there are many cuts at all in the proposed federal budget. So some of this, I think, is directly, you're right on target, is the fact that this is more fear mongering and political rhetoric coming from the Democrats trying to blame Trump, really Trump, for these when they really haven't materialized yet so far. I'm not saying that's not possible. They could come into existence. I mean, we spend a lot of money on Medicaid, for instance, and I could see some reform ultimately there that may cause New York to lose.
That's huge, isn't it, Will? Come on, Medicaid is huge. If that's threatened, that's billions of dollars, and the state could be suffering.
We could be, but shouldn't we look to? We can't just continue to do what we continue to do. It's just not sustainable. So maybe those cuts really, instead of saying cutting the funding, we're really reforming the program and hopefully provide funding to those who need it outside of providing, you know, free health, government health care to everybody in the state.
So, you should probably have a reform plan, though, shouldn't you? Shouldn't you have a reform plan in place before you start cutting things? You can't just cut things without, you know, going line by line and seeing where the value is. What I'm worried about, like with SNAP benefits, you saw Schumer and many out this week screaming about that. These are for the poorest people. These are crumbs to help people get by. People can go hungry as a result of this. So, I mean, isn't that going to affect Republicans in Republican districts as well? Aren't a lot of these rural districts getting a lot of this extra support? And if that goes away, what does that mean?
So ultimately, this is always a problem with government and spending and increases. Of course, none of this is easy. If it was easy, we'd snap our fingers and have it done. Hard decisions have to be made. Some government programs, I would submit, many government programs are very inefficient and don't actually end up achieving what they're supposedly supposed to do. And I think Medicaid is a good example of that. We provide, you know, we have the highest Medicaid spending in the country. We provide more benefits than any other program in the country. So maybe we got to look at ourselves and say, you know, how can we be this far out of whack with, you know, the rest of the nation? And yeah, there are hard decisions. There's no doubt about it. And people probably will not be able to get, if you're really serious about reform, some people that maybe shouldn't be getting the government's largesse, you know, there will be consequences as a result of that. But I just think it's important that we couch this as reforming the system, because everybody hears the word cut. And again, that sends shivers up people's spines. But even, as I said at the beginning, even if they slow the growth of the program, I think it would be incredibly helpful.
What I worry about, Will Barclay, is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that there are legitimate people who have legitimate needs, whether it's a child with a disability, for example, or something like that, that suddenly this program is cut and they have nowhere to go. I mean, you have real problems in our society that get handled by a lot of these government programs. And when that goes away, then there's problems out in the streets. And, you know, that comes back around, right? That comes back around in higher crime rates and other problems that develop, homelessness and everything else. If we're not trying to deal with the problems that are growing, and we're going to cut them for, again, what would be perhaps a smaller percentage of fraud and misuse, then aren't we throwing the baby out with the bathwater before we come up with what you're calling, you know, a reform plan?
Right. Well, obviously, I'm sympathetic to some of those. We want to help our neighbors. We want to make sure those in need can get the help. But, you know, we've been doing this so-called great society for a number of years and continue to increase spending, you know, nationally and the state level, and these problems don't seem to go away. So again, I think if you look at it as a reform and not as a cut, maybe we can get systems in place that work better than the system that we currently have now, just in a broad sense.
All right. Well, let's go on to a major issue that made it to the budget this year and where your Republican conference is on this, the issue of discovery. Remind our listeners what that is and what was worked out in the budget.
So a number of years ago, under the guise of criminal justice reform, they put new discovery requirements in that really required DAs to provide relevant, I think it's even the term, relevant information to the case to defense attorneys, and they had to do it within a certain time period. As a result, this turned into be, I guess, a bigger deal than maybe when it was first initiated or thought was going to happen, and the DAs are having difficulty complying with this rule. As a result, a lot of cases were being thrown out under a speedy trial violations that they couldn't, because the DAs just couldn't satisfy it from a paperwork standpoint. So this tried to tighten that up a little bit. The DAs of New York City had an agreement basically with the legislature. I don't know about the DAs statewide, but it would allow essentially them more time, and the information that they have to provide has been limited to some degree, so it's easier for them to comply with these discovery laws. That's about the best I understand. I have talked to a number of ADAs and DAs from around the state. Some are happy with it because they think it's, you know, a start, but they'd like to go much farther than what's already there. I think they'd like to repeal the whole discovery laws that were enacted, but that's not probably realistic. So my opinion, this was better than nothing, but, it, you know, I'd still like to see some reform of the so-called criminal justice reforms we did in the past, like bail and raise the age, those types of laws that I just don't think are working. They don't work for the community. They aren't working for, obviously, the victims of the crime, and I don't think they work necessarily even for the people committing the crimes, too. So it was a start, though, and I'm happy. You know, I listen to the speaker quite a bit. He says, I don't like to put policy in the budget, and I do agree mostly if we can stick to fiscal issues in the budget, that's fine, but the governor does have the power. This is where she has the negotiating power. If she doesn't get it done in the budget, it's unlikely to get done anywhere else. So let me put it long-winded, saying I'm pleased with that. But again, I think we need to do a lot more work in all regards of criminal justice reforms.
Seems to me it represents a compromise between the Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah. Well, it was even a compromise more so, I think, between the, farther left and the Democratic Party and the governor.
Well, you make a point, because they are certainly not for it. They pushed hard against it. But at the same time, the district attorneys, including Democratic district attorneys, were screaming about it.
Right. And, you know, it's, I hate to say it's a technicality, but these speedy trial violations, people were, you know, actual criminals were getting off.
Yes.
And that's not good. So I'm glad, and hopefully this will at least go a short ways to trying to fix that situation.
Yeah, perhaps a little common sense there. Okay, well,
yeah.
The...
How about the cell phone ban?
Well, that's exactly
that,
right.
That was a good bipartisan one that actually I think almost everybody agreed on.
Well, yeah, and this is a bell-to-bell ban in schools.
Yep. And, you know, I talked to a lot of school districts, a lot of parents about this. I was kind of torn about, I thought a cell phone ban was good, but I was thinking maybe just in class. But I think it's probably cleaner now just getting, you know, cell phones out of schools completely. So I think this was a good policy. I think New Yorkers, I think that polls something like 60 or 70% of New Yorkers agree with that. So there's one, again, complete bipartisan support by both Democrats and Republicans on that issue.
Yeah, and a lot of it surrounding mental health and learning, two areas that are so important to make sure our kids are healthy in school so they can learn.
Right. You know, I can imagine. I mean, I have trouble with myself. You know, I find myself in a meeting or something. I sort of maybe think about other things. And I find myself looking at my phone, which is not healthy for me or the people I'm meeting with, too. So I can only imagine what it's like in the classroom when, you know, it's hard to get kids' attentions anyways. And when they have the ability to at least use their phone, it's probably even harder. So I think that was a good policy initiative that I'm glad got passed.
I'm sorry. Did you say something, Will? I was looking at my cell phone.
I hear it. See, David?
You're listening to The Capital Connection. I'm David Gustini. Here with Will Barkley. He's the Republican New York State Assembly Minority Leader. Now to a plan I know you were against, and many of the Republicans were against, and even some Democrats, including that same senator, James Skoufis, was not in support of the congestion pricing plan in New York City. And now the federal government has been trying to stop that. They keep extending the deadline. But since then, I pulled this article from the Times. It's written by no fewer than five journalists, Will. And it says almost immediately after the tolls went into effect, $9 to enter Manhattan from 60th Street south of the Battery, they began to alter traffic patterns, commuter behavior, transit service, even the sound of gridlock and the on-time arrival of school buses. These reporters got their information from everyone they could think of, including the MTA, the fire department, restaurant booking platforms, researchers, and one yellow school bus company. What did they find? Cars on the street, fewer. Traffic speeds, faster. Peak commute times, faster still. Local buses, faster, less delayed. Traffic outside the zone, not worse. New Jersey commute, and it goes on and on and on. Is it possible that it's a good plan and it's working?
Well, I just am naturally against charging people to drive in New York City. So, you know, I have to look at the article. I have to look at the studies. I know the MTA was, you know, within a day of putting congestion pricing, they were saying how great it is. I've been down there with my own eyes. I didn't notice any difference in traffic, but, you know, that's just anecdotal seeing from my point. But hopefully it actually does have some good outcomes, but you're still charging people $9 to drive in New York City. And how about those poor people that live on 59th or 60th Street, you know, that go in and out of the zone constantly? They're probably paying a lot more than $9. We'll see. I guess let's see we'll see what happens if it gets revoked by the Trump administration. But if it stays in place, I'd like to see those studies and see what the long-term outcome of it is.
Well, when we hear some more, we'll be back to you for sure.
Thank you. David, listen, I will say this. You might be shocked to hear this. I have been wrong on things in the past. I don't think I am on congestion pricing, but for instance, indoor smoking ban was one I voted against, a piece of law. I'm happy that it is now law. And, you know, you can't even imagine going back to those days. So
I know it.
On rare occasions, even I get it wrong. So
you know, that's pretty good. You know, I was wrong once, Will, but then I found out I was mistaken. All right, now let's... I'm kidding. Of course, I'm wrong all the time. And I could be wrong on this because I know we differ on this, and that's medical aid in dying. Now, it's the Senate that would have to pass this now, right?
Yeah, we passed it. Was that 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
In the Assembly, and it was sort of surprising because we were right in the middle of the budget process to bring up such a heavy policy initiative with this aid in dying. I was opposed to it. And I think mostly our conference was opposed to it. And there were several Democrats who were opposed to it. In fact, they've tried to bring it up in years past and they couldn't get it through committee because they didn't have the votes, believe it or not.
Yeah, Crystal Peoples-Stokes doesn't like it.
Yeah. I just think it, you know, there's a slippery, my personal view on it and why I voted against it. It's a slippery slope. And obviously I have compassion to those people that are suffering at the end of life. And, but we've seen euthanasia in other countries and the expansion of it. I think that's where I get concerned, the danger of that, you know, the versus, you know, for terminal illness. And next thing you know, it sort of slides into what's exactly an illness. Is it mental illness? You know, and I just think it's inappropriate for the government to legalize this. And frankly, you know, I think in real life, I don't know how I say this delicately, but there are end of life options out there that are being practiced, you know, even currently. And I don't know, by legalizing it here in the state and legitimizing it, I just think it's going to be a slippery slope and it's going to be prone to, unfortunately, some, you know, very big dangers.
The only thing I'll add to this, Will, is that they've spent 11 years trying to get this legislation passed in New York. 11 years. And yeah. Each time they've come through, they've tried to deal with the objections that you've mentioned. And so this would be harder to take advantage of someone, certainly based on all the safeguards they have placed in the legislation.
Right.
Again, that's been going back and forth over 11 years. And, you know, I just like to think of my cat, Olive, who, you know, who was very sick and suffering. And, you know, I could have the vet come over and relieve her pain and
right.
didn't have to continue to suffer for no reason when we have the medications to make it possible.
Right.
But it is also, to me, a really good lesson in how long these fights can take in New York, right? I mean, we're talking about yeah. years-long processes to get things done.
I agree with you with this legislation that they have tightened it up so they, you know, the risk of abuse is probably less than it maybe was, whatever the initial bill was that was introduced. So I agree with that. Other than now, there'll be another fight where they want to expand. So maybe not under this law, but there'll be compassionate care too. And they'll be looking, that's where I'm talking about a slippery slope. I think once, and again, there is evidence of this happening in other areas of the world. Canada and some places in Europe where I think it's now gone too far. So I know I have to be mindful of that, and I'm going to continue to probably push back whenever I see that happening.
Well, Barclay, what do you make of some of the machinations now with a coming gubernatorial race in New York? We're seeing more than ever Congresswoman Elise Stefanik from the North Country, the Republican who was going to become UN ambassador, that was pulled at the last moment. She now seems to be hinting she's taking a real serious look at challenging Governor Kathy Hochul for governor of New York. And then also we've seen President Donald Trump basically endorsing Bruce Blakeman from Long Island and Congressman Lawler, Mike Lawler, for their current positions, seeming to indicate they, who have been rumored to want to run for governor, shouldn't.
Well, one thing I take, and I think now most New Yorkers know it, is Governor Hochul's poll numbers are in the tank. And so I think the Republicans look at it and we see this as a vulnerability and think that it would be great that the Republican could finally take back the governor's mansion after so many years of Democratic control. So I take that as a very positive signal. I think any of those people you mentioned are going to make great candidates, and I think they'd be great governors. So I'm very heartened by it because in the past, I think some people said we're never going to win the governor's mansion and it's not worth us trying. But here you got three very qualified people that were willing to, are willing, hopefully, to risk a lot, give up their current positions, and run for governor. So I just think that's a very positive signal for Republican Party in New York State. And whether it's Stefanik, whether it's Lawler, whether it's Blakeman, I'm happy that all of them are considering it.
But with someone like Stefanik, who has really embraced the MAGA label, do you think that's a wise move in a more blue state like New York, or does it have an advantage in itself?
Well, generally, I don't think you're going to be able to escape that if it's a negativity, which, you know, sometimes it is in New York. But the Democrats, I presume, are going to label anyone a MAGA candidate. So I don't think whether more moderate members run versus a more conservative, I don't think it's going to make a difference because I think they're going to be painted with that brush regardless.
All right, now here's a
a winning strategy. I mean, who knows where it's still times off. I mean, the economy, everybody's concerned about the economy, but then we get great news, you know, just yesterday with inflation being the lowest point it's been. So, you know, these things can change. It's hard to predict this far out. But the one thing that hasn't changed is that governor's poll numbers continue to tank.
Well, yeah. I'm going to give you a chance for schadenfreude right now. You ready? Talk to me about what's going on with the lieutenant governor, Antonio Delgado, and the rift that has been created with his own governor.
Yeah, I would be interested to hear anybody's opinion on this. I don't know what his strategy is. You know, if he was looking to run for governor, didn't strike me as the best way of going about it. I don't hear much now in the news, so he's kind of faded. He probably would have had a better post to continue on as lieutenant governor, but I guess if he's not really getting along with the governor, maybe that he just said it's not worth it. So from a political perspective, I don't know what he was doing. If it didn't make sense to me, but if he wanted to run for governor, he's certainly now locked in. He can't really run for Congress because I think where he lives is already a Democratic congressional congressman. So you know, there's obviously some history in New York State, both on the Republican side and the Democrat side, with the governor not getting along with their lieutenant governors. So this is not far from being unprecedented.
No, but it's quite something to say, I'm not going to run, and then for them to come back and say, well, we weren't going to have you anyway. You know, this very public spat. So, well, Will Barclay, another show has flown by. Just like that, we're out of time. He is the New York State Assembly Minority Leader, William Barclay. And I can't thank you enough for joining us to talk about your perspective, what's happening in New York State government and politics. And you can bet I'll be finding you again for another conversation.
I hope so. Thank you, David. I always enjoy being on your show.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.